Thank you. Be seated. Justice Cook has voluntarily recused himself in this case under the provisions of Crack Rule 15-8. Justice Gonzalez, we think, has gone to Florida for our ABA chairman meeting. He's not here. We think that's where he is. But he will participate in the decision of this case. The court is now ready to hear argument from petitions in the matter of Joaquin versus First Court of Appeals.
May it please the court, my name is Jimmy Williamson. I represent the petitioner. Petitioner is the plaintiff in an action that is brought in Harris County District Court for legal negligence. An action has been brought against his attorney alleging acts of negligence. The case arises in this issue before this court is the propriety of a sitting trial court judge voluntarily injecting himself as an expert witness into a legal malpractice action.
What if he was spent?
You know, he would. In my opinion, Your Honor, to this case, or to any case like it, namely where a judge is asked to give opinion testimony about the merits of a legal malpractice action, a subpoena or lack of it wouldn't make any difference, because all I would do, if in fact I thought Justice Heck would have opinion testimony favorable to my cause, would be to have someone come serve Justice Heck with a subpoena and then take his deposition. So I don't think the presence or absence of a subpoena is material to the disposition either of this case or cases like it. Okay. And what happened here is Judge Blanton was the judge of the 11th District Court of Harris County, duly elected. He had pending in the 11th District Court a case that involves members of the family, my client Joe Ackland and another member of his family. They were in a dispute. Judge Blanton did not hear that case. He appointed a visiting judge, Judge Goddard, to hear the case. Judge Goddard heard the trial of the or brought the case on for trial and paneled the jury, whereupon a settlement agreement was announced into the record. It was announced on the record, Judge Goddard making a notation on the docket sheet of the 11th District Court, judgment to be entered. Later, the other side, the defendant in this case, of course, represented Mr. Joe Ackland, my client, in the underlying case. Later, the other side defaulted and reneged on that settlement agreement. When they did, Mr. Joe Ackland tried to enforce the settlement agreement. The decision to enforce the settlement agreement by judgment was appealed. Justice Brown of the 14th Court wrote that the settlement agreement was not enforceable because it had not been put in enforceable form at the time that it was dictated into the record. Thereupon, Mr. Joe Ackland had to go back to court with regard to his litigation against his family. He entered into another settlement that was substantially less favorable to him. He brought suit against his lawyer for failing to get that settlement agreement in an enforceable form and fashion. The defendant, at some point in litigation, designates as Judge Blanton. Theoretically, Judge Blanton is, well, not theoretically, Judge Blanton is designated as an expert witness. It is agreed by all parties and by Judge Blanton himself that he does not have knowledge of any fact in this case. There is no fact, material, or otherwise, that Judge Blanton has any knowledge of regarding this matter, which immediately distinguishes this case from several cases in which judges have testified because they are the only, either a primary or the only source of information available to the trier of fact. In this case, Judge Blanton has no facts. The deprivation of his testimony before a jury or of any other judge on his expert opinion testimony before a jury will not deprive the jury of one shred of the picture surrounding this scene at the time it took place. Judge Blanton, however, came in and started to give a testimony and gave an affidavit voluntarily in the case, then later appeared voluntarily for deposition testimony. He said two things. Three things. One is what a judge puts on his docket sheets is exclusively the province of the judge, which, by the way, is not a matter that's contested either here or in the trial court below. Number two, he said Judge Goddard had made a mistake by his notation on the docket sheet. you know, which in my opinion is not a proper subject of expert testimony before a jury anyway, because what Judge Goddard did or did not do, whether it was error or not, is a question of law, and you do not elicit opinion testimony on questions of law. And number three is that any notation that was made or error that was made was not the fault of the attorney. Issue number three is an affirmative opinion voluntarily objected, voluntarily injected in the case by Judge Blanton, upon the merits of the proceeding, because the proceeding directly deals with the negligence of the attorney. We objected before Judge Blanton, at the time he was designated, we objected saying it violated the canons, he should not be called as a witness. We later, Mr. Doherty went on record at the time of his first deposition and so objected. We then presented it to the trial court. Trial court said, go ahead and take his deposition. We went ahead and took his deposition, and the deposition itself highlights part of the problem of having sitting judges being expert witnesses, because Judge Blanton became extremely non-responsive throughout the deposition process. And I invite the court, for those of you who know my partner, I invite the court to look at that transcript, because Mr. Doherty started out that deposition proceeding very solicitous and courteous to Judge Blanton, and Judge Blanton did not respond to questions during the entire transcript, okay, at which time Mr. Doherty terminated the deposition process. That highlights one of the problems of at which time Mr. Blanton and Mr. Doherty got into a disagreement, and Mr. Blanton made certain comments to Mr. Doherty at that time. And that highlights the problem. If you're going to let
the problem here, let me test a little bit. Mm-hmm. That Judge Blanton was ever a judge, or that he is still available to sit by assignment.
That good question. Number one, he is still a judge, and that's so. I'm in the most favorable category under either scenario for this case. He's still a judge. Number two, though, and I supplemented the record here because Mr. Giesel has now said if this court finds that Judge Blanton can't testify, I'm going to get Judge Sondock to testify. Judge Sondock, as y'all all know, was the judge of the 234th through December.
Also a judge of this court.
That's correct. First late female justice of the Texas Supreme Court. And I don't think Judge Sondock will be able to testify as to questions of law. You cannot testify as to pure questions of law. And in fact, this court, when I argued the Milhouse versus Wiesenthal case up here in February last year, that was part of the point of the Milhouse case. What Milhouse says in questions of appellate legal malpractice, you do not submit the issue of proximate cause to the jury, because what the court would have done in the previous case is a question of law. Likewise, what the court would or would not have done upon the proper presentation of the appeal is a question of law. You do not elicit the testimony of Judge Blanton or Judge Sondock on that point.
Well, if the testimony is inadmissible, don't we have to presume that at the trial of the case, the trial judge will not admit it, and therefore there is no irreparable injury in this case, no risk of harm that couldn't be corrected on appeal?
No. Is the answer, Your Honor, and there's two reasons. One is, under the Johnson test, namely it would be a waste of time, money, and prejudicial of parties to proceed, mandamus should issue on that basis. Number two is, though, on an appeal, I'm deprived of something I'm not that I have available at this point. On appeal, the defendant will surely come in and say, sure, Judge Blanton testified, sure, he gave opinion testimony, but it was a harmful error. And all of a sudden, I will have to meet the additional burden of showing harmful error on that appeal, when in fact, he never should be allowed to testify in the first place. And, I'm sorry, did I?
But your point is that his testimony is inadmissible.
Absolutely.
Don't we have to assume that the trial judge won't admit it at trial?
But it's inadmissible for all purposes, because that leads to the third point. Mr. Doherty, and myself for that matter, have now been put in the position of a sitting trial court judge in Harris County. We have the option of cross-examining. Matter of fact, we have the duty of cross-examining him. We have the duty to try to impeach his credibility, to try to impeach his opinion, to try to bring up inconsistent statements he has made in the past, which I would submit might include docket sheets and other judgments. You know, we have that duty. If we do that, we're going to put ourselves in the position of offending a justice or a judge before whom we will have to appear. That's going to cause irreparable harm to us and puts us
in a conflict situation between zealously protecting the rights of our client versus offending a sitting trial court judge.
Why can't you simply ask that he be recused on that basis?
Well, we...
From all future cases in which you might have him as a sitting judge.
Because the government code gives me, in Harris County, and the way it works in Harris County now, the government code gives me one recusal. You know, if I happen to exercise that right of recusal, I could easily draw Judge Blanton as a visiting judge. And in fact, the practice and procedure in Harris County at this time is, if you exercise your motion, because certain attorneys exercise their right of recusal in order to obtain continuances, as opposed to trying to get rid of somebody, because of that, Harris County now has a procedure where if you recuse one visiting judge, you are immediately assigned to another visiting judge to ensure that people do not abuse that right by trying to get a continuance. So I have no justification at all that I will not appear in front of Judge Blank at this time. And that is exactly a judge who is supposed to be impartial and, according to the canons, is not supposed to make any statement about a pending or impending proceeding or a public comment about it. He is not supposed to lend the status of his judicial office to promote the private interest of litigants, and that is exactly what's being done here. And I think the canons prohibit it. I think the canons should prohibit it, because what you do is you draw in to question the impartiality of the judge's system. And mandamus is the only way that you can resolve that issue. So I don't feel that mandamus is in any way inappropriate. And I will say further, mandamus has been used literally probably dozens of times to correct discovery orders granting or denying discovery in the state of Texas. So I clearly feel within the mandamus precedence. The point, and I think I'm within the law of the other jurisdictions at the time that we do this, Helmbrecht was cited by Justice Cook in the Millhouse decision. Helmbrecht is a Wisconsin case where they tried to use a judge to testify the divorce court judge. And what they were going to do is have the divorce court judge testify what he would have done even if the attorneys had properly presented the case to him. And he testified he would have done nothing different. The Wisconsin court, Supreme Court said that's improper. You don't want to let judges do that. We don't want judges to be doing that. You know, California picked up on Helmbrecht in a case called Merritt and says we do not want judges to do that. New Jersey, in a case that I found this morning, it's 561 Atlantic 2nd 649. It is not in my brief. In State versus Grimes, says you do not want the judge to lend, that's a criminal case, you do not want the judge to lend the prestige of his office to help a litigant, or in that case, to help the prosecution. That's improper.
Well, if that's the rule, isn't it too broad? A judge can be subpoenaed to testify as a character witness, for example, in a criminal trial.
Well, there's a question about that, Your Honor. Two things. One is, there's a criminal statute that deals with it that says a judge may be a competent witness, and the question of whether he's competent or not and the question of whether or not he should testify are two different questions. But the judge, even then, even under the criminal system where he's his subpoena, if he testifies there is no fact relevant to the proceeding that's within his knowledge, then he cannot be forced to testify. That's 38.13.
Well, but the canons permit him to testify about the character of the defendant, if subpoenaed. Or are they sort of backhandedly? Is that correct or not?
I don't recall any canon dealing with that.
The judge should not testify voluntarily in an adjudicated proceeding as a character witness, but that implies that he could testify if he was subpoenaed as a character witness.
That's not what that implies to me, Your Honor. What that implies to me is two things. One is he should not volunteer himself as a witness into a proceeding, and number two, it certainly appears to limit any testimony he would give to the position of being a character witness or not being a character witness. And in fact, if you look at Texas law on this subject, Young versus State says only in the rarest when a criminal court judge was called to testify to ID a defendant. All he did was identify the defendant as the same man who had previously been in his court, which is a fact, by the way, and which is a fact which was relevant to the case. And even then, the Court of Appeals was critical. It said it wouldn't reverse the case, but it's critical of him testifying. O'Neill versus State, also, I think it's 1927, Court of Criminal Appeals, said only in the rarest of circumstances should a judge put himself in the position of becoming a witness. That's the law in Texas before the canons are adopted in 1965. It's the law in Texas before any other statutory law in the matter.
Is his disqualification a matter of competence or a matter of ethics?
Both. To the extent of opinion testimony. If, for example, I can conceive of facts and circumstances where a judge would be called upon to give factual testimony that would be available from no other source. And in that case, his testimony should be limited to that factual testimony. Giving opinion testimony about the merits or demerits of a pending legal proceeding when the issue is one that's going to come up or have the potential to come up repetitiously in the courts of the state of Texas, and has the potential to come up again, because this question of when the judgment rendered and what an attorney should do to get a judgment rendered could very well come in front of Judge Blanton, could come in front of this court, could come in front of any of the courts of the state in terms of what's the duty of an attorney, which, by the way, leads us to the issue of what really is the issue the jury is going to be determining in this case is not what the judge should or should not have done. The issue the jury should be looking at is what should a reasonably prudent attorney have done in the presentation of this case. If there are additional instructions that the court needs to give to explain the law about docket sheets or about rendition or about the law of settlements in the state of Texas, those instructions come from the trial court judge in this proceeding. They do not come from the witness stand, either from lawyer witnesses or from judge witnesses.
Can you give me your idea about what the relationship between this canon is and the canon that says that judges shall not endorse candidates or raise money?
Canon 7, which has recently been...
Is there any analogy there about the judge using his influence, or is it a completely different question?
No, I think there is an analogy, Justice Spears. I'm going to turn for a second.
I wonder if you have any authority for it, or...
It's hard to obtain authority from the Commission on Judicial Conduct, because what they told us was they did not desire to release their opinions to us. Therefore, what opinions that I have received from the Commission have come from third-party sources like such intimate legal sources as the Texas Lawyer and other publications, but where you pick it up third hand. But yes, it is, because to me, the overriding theme of all the canons, Canon 5, which says you shall not lend the prestige of your office to further a private interest, or Canon 3, which says you shall not comment on pending or impending proceeding, or Canon 3, which says you shall not have an ex parte communication with a counsel regarding the merits or demerits of a case. Also, that philosophy underlies Canon 7, which is you're prohibited from making statements that indicate an opinion on any issue that may be subject to judicial interpretation by the office which the candidate is seeking, except that you may explain your judicial philosophy. What I think that means is that you can't come up and say, look, and let me see if I can pick an issue that is totally foreign to the issue that I'm presenting here. Look, I'll tell you how I'm going to vote when that abortion rights case hits my court. I'm going to vote this way. I'm going to tell everybody that's the way I'm going to vote in advance. And I think the canons say, no, that's not what we want. And the reason you don't want that, of course, is you prejudge a case, which you're not supposed to prejudge cases. You're supposed to judge every case on its merits as it comes up. And I think that's going to cause a judge to say nothing of the appearance and impartiality. Does that answer the court's question?
No, not really.
I'm sorry.
My question really had to do more with the judge lending his office or using his office to achieve a certain result. Litigation.
And that's exactly what's happening here, then. But I mean, in that respect, I don't think candidates are any different from the other judicial officers who are sitting within the state, that they are prohibited from doing that. And here, the only result that will happen, we're not talking about a statement made to the fourth grade elementary class at Lamar Elementary in Houston on how the judges go about reaching decisions. We're talking about arguing whether or not Mr. Joachim gets money from Mr. Cabot and Mr. Cabot's insurance carrier. I mean, it is purely a private dispute that is clearly a monetary dispute in nature. Let me give the court an example. You know, what will prevent, if the court says Judge Blanton can do this, what will prevent me from making a phone call to all nine members of this court next week and say, I would like to fly to Austin and consult with you on being an expert witness on what constitutes rendition or non-rendition of judgment. Now, I submit to you, if I made that phone call, I just can't imagine the response I would obtain. I mean, if you can imagine the response you would give me in response to that phone call, which would be to basically hang up on me, that itself demonstrates the impropriety of the matter.
For any further questions, I think I will say the remainder of the part. We'll sit down.
Any other questions? Thank you. The court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
Next, please, the court, Alex Musil will present arguments for the respondent.
May it please the court, I'm Alice Giesel, the law firm of Giesel, Stone, Barker, and Lyman. And at the council table with me is my husband, Henry Giesel, who was the trial counsel in this case. And if the court has any questions that they might want to ask him about the case, he's available for the court to do so if they wish. It is our position that Judge Blanton, of course, is not prohibited from testifying in this case as a witness, either by the rules or the canons of judicial ethics. Rule 605 of the Texas Rules of Civil Evidence provides that a judge presiding at a trial may not testify in that trial as a witness. And I think obviously then this rule recognizes that there are situations where a judge may appear as a witness in a case an example I might give is the recent case of Lulac versus Maddox, with which the court is familiar. I know that in that, before Judge Lucius Bunton, I know that in that case there were a number of judges who testified. I also know there were a number of judges who were parties to that case, either because of their positions or because they intervened. I ordered a copy of the docket sheet and the witness list and tried to sort out if any judges testified who were not parties. And frankly, there were just too many of them, and I couldn't decide. But that is a case where judges have indeed testified. Plaintiff's objection at the trial court level was that this was a violation of Canon Rule 38A, which prohibited public comment about a pending or impending proceeding in any court. And that canon, of course, has now been changed to restrict this to a proceeding before that judge's court, impending in that judge's court. So it obviously is not pertinent here.
I assume you agree with the petitioner that he could call witnesses to contradict Judge Blanton, other judges to testify about the same subject.
Certainly, Your Honor.
Doesn't the spectacle of judges parading across the witness stand testifying about legal matters trouble you at all?
I don't think it has to be a spectacle, Your Honor. I think if you read Judge Blanton's testimony in his original deposition, he was very careful to testify as to the nature of a judge's docket entry, who is responsible for it. He testified that this is the judge's responsibility. He has absolute control over it. An attorney has no power to tell the judge what to put in his docket sheet, which is the judge's memorandum, and that in his opinion, a lawyer has no obligation to tell the judge. If a trier of fact is to determine if there was negligence in regard to a docket entry, they have to know what a docket entry is. And I don't think that it is necessarily left only up to the presiding judge to instruct the jury on that. I think the jury is entitled to hear testimony regarding the nature of a docket entry. I don't think that Judge Blanton should be asked or will be asked the ultimate question, which is if the lawyer in this case had said, please put in your docket judgment rendered, whether Judge Goddard would have or should have changed the docket entry. He's not going to be asked that. That is going into the probable mental processes or actions of the judge,
Judge Blanton was asked at deposition whether he thought the attorney was negligent in this case, in essence.
He was asked whether the attorney should have asked the judge to make a docket entry.
And he answered no.
He answered no, because it is his opinion that the making of docket entries is the judge's prerogative. If the questions asked of the judge go beyond what the judge should testify to, then I think that's a matter to be handled at the trial court level. I don't think that makes Judge Blanton incompetent to testify, or any judge incompetent to testify about what is essentially a court procedure.
Do you think there is anything to the concern that a lawyer might have in vigorously cross-examining a sitting judge?
Well, we come to the question of vigorous examination. I think that it is possible to effectively cross-examine a witness without offending that witness. I think it is possible to effectively cross-examine a witness, a judge, any witness, without using Rambo techniques, without being overly aggressive, without being discourteous. If there is a problem there, then some of our lawyers may learn better manners.
But do you think there would be a difficulty in suggesting to a judge testifying as an opinion witness that he had taken the contrary view on other occasions and was obviously not telling the truth on this one?
I don't think I would say obviously not telling the truth.
You phrase it a little differently.
I don't know that I would.
You just eliminate the word obviously.
I think I might eliminate the whole sentence, because I think that there is a way, an effective way, to cross-examine a judge.
From what I'm told, and I haven't read it myself, but at the judge's deposition, he was not responsive to the questions.
Your Honor, I will have to admit that he was not responsive.
It's a difficulty for the counsel taking the deposition to really establish anything, didn't it?
That made it difficult, and I'm sorry that deposition happened from both sides. There was fault on both sides in that, Your Honor. The judge was subpoenaed to appear. The deposition was set without the usual courtesies, which are given to medical witnesses routinely, of an inquiry as to when the deposition is convenient and at what place. Such depositions are often taken at the doctor's office. This was not done in this case. Also, reading a deposition, there are attitudes, tones of voice, and things that do not come across. I think Judge is probably put out that he had the opportunity to give his testimony before on cross-examination. Opposing counsel did not cross-examine at this time, went back to the trial judge and said, now we have proof that Judge Blanton is a visiting judge. We had never denied that he was a visiting judge. So he'd come back for a second deposition. It was inconvenient for him.
Regardless of the motives and circumstances,
yes,
though, it does present a difficulty for a lawyer to cross-examine a judge effectively under those circumstances.
It does, and I still think, though, that it could have been handled better.
Well,
it's a difficulty, yes.
I'd hate to be in the position of a lawyer who was cross-examining a judge like that in this circumstance and wasn't getting responsive answers.
That is true. And at the end, I think Judge Blanton was eager to explain his answers. He was interrupted. Perhaps he should have said yes or no and then explained his answers. But he was interrupted and was not permitted to give full answers. There was fault on both sides. We will admit that. And perhaps it does demonstrate that there can be a problem. But I don't think that that makes the judge incompetent to testify. I don't think that it means that his being a witness in a case is in violation of the canons of judicial ethics.
Let me ask you this. You ask a district judge to testify as an expert witness on this subject that's presently before the case, and he states in his deposition that he believes it is his opinion that there's no negligence on the part of the attorney, and the judge should have made a different docket entry. If that judge were later an appellate judge and the same case came before him, would he be bound to give the same opinion that he had testified to in the earlier case.
I would think he would recuse himself, Your Honor. You know, I don't think we are going to have a great wave of judicial testimony and that our courthouses are going to be invaded by testifying attorneys. I don't think that this situation is going to come up that much. Judges, I don't think, are anxious to testify, and I don't believe that there are going to be that many situations where it is really necessary to have the testimony of a judge in order to get a fair trial. I think that this is a situation where such testimony is necessary, either from a judge who is presently sitting, either as a judge of a particular court, as a visiting judge. If this court feels that this would not be proper, I certainly see nothing wrong with having a former judge testify. And for that reason, we put the name of Honorable Ruby Sondop, who is a former judge, as an alternate witness if this court feels that Judge Blanton should not testify.
Do you find the case of Milhouse versus Wiesenthal that this court recently wrote, but limited it in its holding at least to appellate malpractice? Do you find that case to be persuasive here, helpful, or irrelevant?
I think it is relevant in that once the nature of a docket entry is before the jury and what the customary practice is as to lawyers dictating to a judge or suggesting to a judge what should be put on the docket, this raises the question of the duty of a lawyer, whether he has a duty to suggest docket entries. But I think the ultimate question of what a judge should do if a lawyer makes a suggestion is a question of law, because that is not a decision that is made by the trier of fact or by a jury. That is a judge's decision, just as appellate review is a judge's decision. And I would think at that point it becomes a question of law for the trial judge. Does that answer your question? I think that there is a relationship there, and I think that in this particular case, court would need to sort out what questions are decided by the jury and what questions are decided by the court. If I may speak briefly on the cases that were cited, the out-of-state cases that were cited in the other brief. I think if the court looks at the case of Phillips versus Clancy, it gives numerous instances where the judges were allowed to testify. Factual matters in a prior proceeding or the testimony of a witness who is no longer available because of death or absence from the state or physical or mental disability, this sort of thing. I don't think the court, opposing counsel, finds any problem with the few instances where this might arise. And, excuse me, the Phillips court condemned testimony where the judge's impressions are sought on issues such as the reputation or credibility of a witness. What the result would have been, I think there's one case, if a case had been presented to the judge or if certain evidence had been presented. The two Helmbrecht and Merritt cases, they inquired, the judge was in testifying as to his probable mental processes, how he would have ruled if a proper presentation had been made, or as to his actual mental processes as why he ruled in a certain way, and he testified the witness had not been persuasive. I think that's the difference between factual matters in a prior proceeding and impressions or mental processes as a judge. And Judge Blanton's testimony really does not fit quite into either category. In a sense, he's being a factual witness, because he's being an expert witness because he is going to be testifying. He's giving his expert opinion as to how docket entries are handled in courts in general. And he is also testifying factually, how such entries are handled in his court, in his experience. And, of course, it was in his court that the prior action took place. Judge Goddard, as you know, now deceased and is unable to testify, and I think that Judge Blanton, of all judges, is probably the next best evidence giver. So his testimony is really both expert testimony and factual testimony.
Before you go to another subject, I have to express my concern about getting into a battle of judges testifying in cases like this. I was on the trial bench for 10 years, and there were a number of situations in which you could have had a trial judge come in and say, well, this is the way we do it, and this is the way it should have been done, and so forth. It seems to me like that cheapens the process of fact-finding to the jury. And also it cheapens the position of the judge, having as a hired gun. And I have to, even though this may be a deal against my best self-interest, I think it applies to some extent to retired judges. I just have a real problem with bringing judges in to testify about even factual matters, although I wouldn't rule out every fact that they would be called on to testify, but in determining what was done meant this and meant that. Can you allay my fears any by some statement of public policy as to why judges should be allowed to enter into these swearing matches?
Because they are the best ones to testify in some situations, because they have had the experience with the rules. I think, frankly, that your fears are unfounded, because I do not think that this is going to happen to some great extent. I think that if it does become a problem, this court can always amend the Code of Judicial Ethics to reach this.
We didn't think Rambo tactics would come out of the rules of discovery and so forth that we promulgated, some 8 or 9 years ago, but to have.
That's true. I hope the court does something about it.
And I see something about swearing matches between judges and former judges as some foreseeable consequence, at least. If we allow a judge's testimony as to what his opinions are about this case.
Perhaps attorney self-interest will keep such Rambo tactics from being used, at least when you're cross-examining a judge. It may even start a trend.
Well, it intimidates them, for sure.
I mean, we may even, in tune with the times, become a kindler and gentler bar.
Wouldn't it be just a cleaner process to say that judges should not testify except under certain circumstances? But not as to factual matters or sitting judgment on questions about what another judge has done and so forth in the evidentiary part of it.
There is no such canon at present, and that, of course, that is what we're going under.
That's
the court.
What this case is all about, is what I'm saying.
Yes. I would have difficulty envisioning exactly how that would be worded to permit the situation where judges could testify. If the court should change the judicial canons, of course, to make that the rule, then of course all judges, including Judge Blanton, would abide by it. But I think the rules as written now do not prohibit such. They prohibit impartiality, rather a judge should not act so as to reduce public confidence in the impartiality of judges, and they should not lend the prestige of their office. I think, of course, any time a judge is called, he's called by one side or another. Obviously, his testimony is going to help one side or another.
Well, I confess I'm less concerned about this case than I am what the ramifications of what we do in this case are. Just leave it at that. I didn't mean to take all your time. I see your lights on. So go ahead with your argument.
Your Honor, I think I have completed my argument and said all that I feel I need to say about this case. Is there no other questions?
Thank you, Kim.
May it please the court. One of the most unpleasant afternoons I've ever spent as a lawyer was in the 280th District Court when I produced an expert witness who was cross-examined with no Rambo tactic, but for 6 hours over his previous testimony in which he had been an expert in every conceivable subject. There was nothing improper about that cross-examination, but the question I have now, and it was...
Trial wrong, judge was not erroneous in letting it in.
No, as a matter of fact, he was not. Yeah. And,
trial judge present?
Yeah. Yeah. The, the question is, do you want judges to do this? Do you want to be coming down when a judge goes on the record and sanctions a lawyer for failing to answer interrogatories or for failing to produce documents? Do you want that judge subpoenaed to the courthouse and have to give testimony about every case he's ever ruled in and why he subpoenaed this particular, why he sanctioned this particular lawyer? When this opinion, when the opinion in Milhouse versus Wiesenthal is written, do you want a lawyer to be able to subpoena the justice of the Texas Supreme Court who wrote that opinion and say, look here, right here in this opinion, you say, the trial court or the attorneys in the trial court should have preserved this error. Didn't you say that, Justice Hex? And isn't that indicating that you're critical of the attorneys in the trial court?
That just would apply to appellate judges, though.
Well. No, because trial court judges could be on the record. Trial court judges could have said on the record, I think you should have produced corporate representative X for deposition, and failure to do so was a sanctionable strike of pleading. And then you're going to subpoena the trial court judge to say, why did you strike those pleas?
We are in, I suspect, in the infancy of legal malpractice litigation. If I may make that hazard a prediction that I don't want to be bound by it, but let's assume that we are. Are you saying that anybody that's ever served as a judge, however briefly, is then just simply disqualified as an expert witness?
No. And the court is right. From the fact I have appeared twice before this court in the last year on legal malpractice cases, the court may assume that I'm doing some of that work, and that is correct. And in those cases, I'll tell you, all of the judges are completely correct. This affects almost virtually every legal negligence case in my office, certainly everyone involving litigation. And we have refrained at this point in time, we have refrained from contacting trial court judges and saying, now how would you have ruled if that attorney had done such and such? Because quite frankly, we always felt we were compelled to refrain from doing that based upon the canon that says we shall not assist a judge and violate the canon.
But we have a number of former judges, some who served on this court, who are testifying in these types of cases.
And
what we write here is that we write a certain way and write broadly enough may have tremendous impact on that. And I'm wondering what the problem is with that. If a practicing lawyer has been a professor, has written law review articles, and has been a clerk and has practiced law and also has been a judge. I mean,
and the answer to that question is, in my opinion, Your Honor, he may give testimony. A former judge who is no longer sitting could give testimony as a lawyer because he's not a judge. He may not give testimony that constitutes a judge's testimony. He may not.
So not to testify in this case, you have no problem as a giving opinion testimony, as long as she doesn't certify that she's available to the former judge. No problem with her giving opinion legal testimony, as long as it's not opinion testimony solely related to a judge's conduct.
I wouldn't say I have no problem, but what I would say, Your Honor, if Judge Sundock is a licensed attorney and is not on the bench, and is not subject to the canon, then it seems to me that Judge Sundock, Ms. Sundock, to make the point, is entitled to give evidence as to, under Birchfield, as to whatever you give evidence on the legal negligence case, i.e., what would a reasonably prudent lawyer do or not do under these set of circumstances. She is not entitled, in my opinion, at any time, nor for that matter are any of the lawyer women entitled to give testimony. This is what a judge would do. This is the way judges handle things. This is the way judges proceed. Well, this is what judges should have done.
Well, obviously, in this case, the judge's notation is very important. I don't know the underlying facts, but that seems fairly clear. The doctor.
No question.
Is that something that the trial judge will make an instruction to the jury on, or the jury just guesses about it kind of in a
No. No. I think the trial judge, and in fact, if you look at the cases that have examined this issue in detail, which are from other jurisdictions, Helmbrecht, Choctaw, Phillips, what they say is you're dealing with an objective standard, and that there, and that's how you got the Milhouse. You don't deal with what a judge would have done. You don't deal with what Judge Goddard would have done. You deal with what a judge should have done if, in fact, the case had been properly presented. There's going to be three categories. One is questions of law, and what Milhouse and all the other jurisdictions do, which is the reason I lost Milhouse in this court, is say when you've got a pure question of law, when you got a pure question of law, that you let a judge decide it. And even in the subsequent trial, you'll let a judge decide it. Second one's a pure question of fact. Was the driver of the car negligent in the previous case, for example? That's a question of fact. You clearly submit that question of fact to the jury, okay, under the case within a case doctrine. The third question is going to be where you have mixed questions of fact and law. A good example is, in fact, I think the Phillips case, where an administrative law judge was going to determine the right to disability benefits. That's a mixed question of fact and law. And what the Phillips court and Helmbrecht and Choctaw seem to say is, what you do is you still submit that issue to the trier of fact, but you submit it to the trier of fact with appropriate instructions as to the law so that they may decide what the reasonable person would have done, what the reasonable judge would have done. So the answer to your question is yes, the trial court judge is going to give those instructions as he deems appropriate, he or she does.
Do you think this is better a matter for the canons or for judicial opinion?
Well, I think the canons of judicial conduct should be treated no differently than the canons regulating attorney's conduct. And of course, the O'Quinn versus State Bar case says the attorney's canons are to be treated like statutes. I don't see any difference for the canons that are promulgated regarding judicial conduct, since those canons are promulgated pursuant to the authority of the Texas Constitution, why they should not also be treated as statutes. Therefore, the effect is the canons are appropriate place to deal with the subject, but those canons should be enforceable in civil action, is my answer to that.
When is this case set for trial?
Well, it's not presently set. As a matter of fact, to our knowledge, I think it's set in the next couple of months, but all parties and I think the trial court have agreed the case will not proceed to trial until this matter is resolved.
I can confirm that.
You know, the... Oh, I wanted to raise two other points. One is I don't think you want to have judges worrying about that. I don't think you want judges to make those points on the record. You don't want to have judges thinking when they make those comments about sanctions. When a trial court comes in and chews a lawyer out for not doing what he's supposed to do, you don't want the trial court saying to himself, I really got to pay attention to what I say, because you know I'm going to be later called upon to defend this action. I'm going to be later called upon to explain it in the subsequent legal malcase out of that matter. You know? Oh, and the other point I was going to make is Judge Chambers noted that Judge Blanton was non-responsive twice in the record, and it was agreed that he was. But Judge Chambers, one of the comments he made, which I think also highlights the problem of having judges as witnesses, he said, and this is in the hearing, he said, who am I to tell him what to do? He was on this bench 20 years, and I've been on it 4. And that highlights another problem. Judges, when you make them witnesses, are not going to be treated as other witnesses, because the other trial court judges are going to be reluctant to treat them according to the same rules of conduct. They are going to be reluctant to criticize their peer. I think that more than covers it. Thank you, Your Honor.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The foregoing causes are submitted on brief to all arguments. That concludes the business of the court for the day, and the marshal will please adjourn the court.
United States Supreme Court of Texas now stands adjourned, subject to call.